Hi, Eloheinu melech haolam, asher bachar banu mikol hamim, v'natan lanu et torato, baruch atah Adonai, noten haTorah. Today we are beginning a new book of the Torah, which is the book of Bamidbar. And Bamidbar comes on page 726. Thank you, Naomi. Parsha Bamidbar, which literally means in the desert, but as you see in the heading in English, it's called Numbers. And that's because in this Parsha, there is a counting of the Jewish people. But it's interesting because even according to our sages, this book is called, has the title of being about numbering, which is kind of interesting because if you think about all of the different Parshas that are in this book of the Torah, the numbering seems to be like the least significant thing, because the other stories that we're going to come across in the Parsha are going to be about the sin of the spies, about the rebellion of Korach, we have the death of Miriam. We have a lot of things going on that you'd think if you're going to give a name to the whole book, that it seems kind of unusual. So that's actually a story for another time and understanding. It has to do with the idea, and we've actually talked about it a couple of years ago, about the idea that the word for counting, lifkod, which means to count, also has to do with remembering and identifying something's importance or significance, of calling something to be remembered and to be accounted for, and that we count things that count. So what counts are the Jewish people, and so you could say that this entire book is about the fact that the Jewish people count and that what the Jewish people do matters. So while Numbers, in English, has probably the most generic sounding name of a book of Torah, that's really what we're talking about in a Jewish context. What we're going to talk about today is about the formation of the Jewish people into their encampments. And those encampments are described in this Parsha, starting with chapter 2 on page 733. And we're going to look at this is based on exclusively on a shir by Mrs. Shira Smiles, and it's going to be looking at two midrashim about the encampment, about what the encampment meant for the Jewish people then and what encampment means for us today, so that hopefully we can learn those lessons. So we're going to open up on chapter 2, page 733, verses 1 and 2. So, Joanne, would you like to start?
Hashem spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "The children of Israel shall encamp, each man by his banner, according to the insignias of their father's household. At a distance surrounding the tent of meeting shall they encamp."
Okay. And then it goes on, and we will look at it, that there will be those who encamp on the east, and it names each of the encampments, who's going to be on the east, who's going to be on the south, who's going to be on the north, and who's going to be on the west, and we'll go into that a little bit. But mostly what we're going to talk about is this idea of encampment, and in addition to that, in addition to having camps, each of the encampments is also going to have a flag, and that the flag is designated for each tribe based on the color of the stone that was in the priest's breastplate, so that their flag would be a representation, just like, you know, like a state or a nation would have their color and then their flag that would have some sort of matching coordinating color. So the Midrash says that God commands the Jewish people to have encampments and that they're going to have an insignia. So it says here, each man by his banner, which is a flag, according to the insignia of their father's household, that's where they're going to be. So the first Midrash says is that the Jewish people wanted to have flags. They wanted to have flags, which is kind of an interesting thing. Like, what does that mean? So there's a Midrash that says that when God came down to Mount Sinai to give the Jewish people the Torah, that God was accompanied by a heavenly host, and a heavenly host of angels, and that the angels all had flags. And that the Jewish people saw that and like, we want flags. So you could say, well, is this like your typical, I want a flag too? It's like, what does that mean? They wanted flags, like we want to have flags. So we'll come back to that. But it was based on the idea that the malachim, the angels, all had flags. The Jewish people saw that, and they also wanted. So there's the rest of the Midrash says that Moshe was very worried about this idea of giving the Jewish people flags and having them be in an encampment. And about the encampment, what do you think Moshe is thinking? That when he gives an assignment, okay, Yehuda and Yisachar and Zebulun, you're going to be on the east, and this group is going to be on the south, this one's going to be north, and this west, and this one's going to be north. What do you think Moshe's concern is?
Jealousy.
Jealousy. As soon as you tell anybody that they need to be a certain place, they already, Dafka, don't want to be there. How come he gets the east? I wanted to be on the east. I wanted to be next to Yehuda. How come I'm over here with the tribe of Dan? He's like, this is going to be a disaster. This is asking for trouble. This encampment idea, because they haven't had an encampment yet. So there's going to be an encampment. That's going to be a disaster. There's going to be complaining. There's going to be fighting. It's going to be terrible. And I don't know if I can deal with all the contentiousness and everything that's going to arise. However, God responds to Moshe and says, don't worry, Moshe. This one is going to work out. There's not going to be any complaining. There's not going to be any problem. It's going to work out perfectly. Why? Because the tribes already have been prepared for going in an encampment and having designated places because of what Yaakov Avinu, Jacob, taught them, because Jacob had the tribes already go in the formation when they carried his casket from Egypt to Israel, to the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, to Hebron, to be buried. So you don't need to worry. Jacob already has kind of set things in motion, and so everything's going to be fine. So now we want to answer this question. What does that have to do with anything? So first of all, what difference does that make? So let's take a look at it. So if we go back to Yaakov's burial, that Yaakov makes Joseph swear that he will take his bones out, his body out, and he will carry his casket, and he will be buried in the land of Israel. And he tells them, and it's according to this, all of the tradition says, that the encampment that we're going to read here, that we do read here, is the exact same formation in a rectangle or in a square that the Jewish people, that the sons, the original sons, who are the proto tribes, carried Jacob's casket, and that Jacob assigned them to do that, how to do that. So the question is, what does this mean for us, and what did it even mean for them? So first of all, we have an issue, which is Jacob lived hundreds and hundreds of years before the Jewish people are now millions of people now in the desert. Why would they really care? Like hundreds of years ago, Jacob told his sons how they were going to stand around the casket and how they were going to carry him into the land of Israel. And so you don't need to worry. So it says, what was it that Jacob did? So we're going to look at this at three different levels. So the first thing is that Jacob tells the Jewish people, or tells his sons at the time, that he gives them their blessings before he dies. He gives them their blessings, and he tells them what each of their strengths are and what each of their challenges are, what their unique qualities are, and what their destiny is supposed to be. And more so than what is going to be, how they fit into the whole, what their role is. And he has them surround his casket and to give the message that each of their individual qualities can be united and focused on a central idea, and they can be focused on him because he's the father of them all. In a way, you could say Jacob is like the white light, and each of the tribes is one of the colors that would be refracted out from the white light. But when they have a common mission of carrying Jacob's casket, that then they can all be united with one focus, and that they can bring themselves together. Because obviously, when you're carrying a casket, if somebody lets go, you know, God forbid, if you've never been to a funeral, when the pallbearers, if somebody lets go and is not part of it, it throws the whole thing off. You could actually end up, God forbid, you know, dropping the body, you're dropping the whole casket. So everybody has to be equally balanced around. Everyone has an equal part. Everyone has to carry their weight. So that he was telling his sons, is telling the Jewish people, that this is not just about carrying my casket. This is how you will in the future go forward. You as the Jewish people, when you go forward, and that he, Yaakov, makes a promise to his son saying, in the future, God will put you in an encampment like this, and you will do the exact same thing. You will work together with a surrounding focus to be able to move forward even with all of your differences. As we fast forward through Jewish history at this at the time of where we're reading now, now there's going to be a central focus for the Jewish people, a physical central focus, and what's that going to be? Or what is that already now? The Beit HaMikdash when we get to the Jerusalem, and the Mishkan in the desert. So what's interesting is the formations are not commanded to be made until the Mishkan is built. It's like until you have a unifying force, all of these differences and unique qualities can probably only cause trouble. It's only when there is a unifying force that is so strong that it can pull everything together. And that's what Yaakov is telling his children. Just as you are coming together and I am your father and I am the unifying force for all of you, so too in the future there will be a unifying force of the Mishkan, the Beit HaMikdash, that will bring you all together, and you will be able to bring all of your unique talents, and instead of having it be a reason for conflict, that it'll be a cause for unification. And that this is a miracle, which we can understand. This is a miracle to bring the Jewish people together, because each of these tribes, it wasn't just, oh, they're a little bit more outgoing, and they're a little bit more shy, and they're a little bit more organized, and a little bit, you know. It wasn't that. These were qualities that were so strong and pervasive, and you know that whenever you get people who are get together who have strong personalities, in fact, sometimes what people say when people don't get along, it's like they'll kind of just say, to be polite, they'll say, strong personalities. And what that basically means is when you have two people who are very strong, it's very possible, very likely that there's going to be conflict. So that this was a blessing to the Jewish people, and that Yaakov gives this blessing, in addition to the blessing he gives each individual tribe, he also blesses them as a group. And that the blessing of the group is that they may be blessed to be able to bring their qualities together and work in common purpose, and that that is not only what will allow the group purpose to move forward, but will actually enhance their own individual personal qualities. Because it's really only in the context of other people that our best qualities are able to reach their greatest potential. Just by myself, with myself, and for myself, I can have all whatever my talent. I mean, even just think of, you know, whoever does anything, somebody who plays an instrument. They may have the musical talent, but they need the group of people who builds the instrument. So by definition, everything is a unified experience, but we tend to lose sight of that. So that this is what Yaakov was telling his sons, and this is what the comfort is, that when Hashem is telling Moshe, you don't need to worry because the Jewish people have had this set into them by their father Yaakov. A second idea is that Yaakov wanted to set into the Jewish people the idea that when there is stress or challenge, it is human nature for people to devolve. That is human nature, that the veneer of civility tends to kind of wither away very quickly. That when there is, you know, if there's shortness of food, for example, what do people do if there's a shortage of food?
Hoard.
I mean, even if you hear like they hoard and they'll be fighting in lines. And I remember even like, some people are too young to remember this, but the gasoline shortages, people would be, you know, doing things to, I was here first, I was in line first, and, you know, doing everything to get the advantage. And that's human nature. That's how things normally go. So it's the Jewish people. At the time of Yaakov's death, it says that the death of Yaakov was also a crisis. You could say, well, people lose their parents all the time, so it's not happy, but it's not a crisis. It says it was a crisis because they were in Egypt. Yaakov was not just their father. He was the leader of what was the Jewish people. It's like when the leadership leaves any place, organization, it's always a time of crisis. even if somebody gets fired and they're the president or the CEO, the organization kind of, everyone starts jockeying for position, and it brings out the worst in people, not usually the best. Yaakov wanted to show his children that they could come together in a time of crisis and a time of struggle and stress and remain attached to each other's and help each other. So this actually shed light for me on the commentary that we know that when the Jewish people were in Egypt and being persecuted, that it says one of the merits of the Jewish people is that they continued to do acts of chesed for one another. They did acts of kindness for one another. So the question is, like, why is that such a big deal? It's like, because that's a big deal. When people are oppressed, it tends to be each person for themselves and maybe each person for their family. But even that's not necessarily a guarantee. But it tends to be survival of the fittest, and I take care of me, you take care of you, and it brings out the worst in people. Yaakov wanted them to see by coming together around his coffin and taking it to Israel that they would be able to come together in a time of crisis and persevere and actually reach heights, because that's the real test of somebody. It's easy to be civil. I guess I shouldn't even say it's easy, because it's apparently not so easy. It's easier to be civil when things are going well. If there's plenty of food, that there's no crisis, there's no violence, there's no anything, people can be fine. But take that away and have there be a shortage of food or a threat of danger or violence or anything else going on that's a struggle, people tend to lose their civility pretty quickly. Yaakov wanted to teach his children, and therefore the Jewish people, that was not going to be the way of the Jewish people, and in fact it hasn't been. So interestingly, in Egypt it wasn't the case. You could say, oh, well, that's maybe like a nice story that's told about the Jewish people after the fact and looking back and kind of romanticizing it, that people did favors for one another. But first of all, since we know that we're told when the Jewish people aren't doing the right thing, we do tend to hear about it, as we hear later in Bamidbar. We do hear about if the Jewish people are doing something wrong and what the consequence is going to be. So the fact that we don't hear about it gives us a strong allusion to that. But we even have our more recent history of stories from the Holocaust, of what people's like. How is it that people were not killing each other over a morsel of bread? It didn't happen. Maybe there was like one or two exceptions, but it did not turn into a jungle environment. It wasn't like a Lord of the Flies type thing. I remember reading that, and everybody becomes animalistic. How come the people did not become animalistic? And in fact, shared bread, shared blankets. There's even a story that Rabbi Fran tells about a person who was a concentration camp inmate, and he was called to the commandant's office, which usually meant you weren't coming back and you were going to be killed and that was going to be it. And so he gave, before he left, he gave everything he had, which was nothing, to his remaining friends who were in the bunk that he was in, including a few morsels of bread he gave to somebody, and his shoes, because those were also, if you didn't have shoes, that was a sure path to death, because then you had no protection. And he gave whatever little anything he had, he gave away. He was taken away to the commandant's office, and miraculously he was returned. And he was still alive. And what would you think if you had been the recipient of the bread and then this person comes back?
He gave it away.
It's like, it's mine now, you know, and that this person, that the first words out of his mouth were, Baruch Mechaye Hametim, blessed is the one who resurrects the dead. Thank God you weren't killed. I didn't eat the bread yet. He could have also said that he ate it, hide it, keep it for later. Remember, this isn't like you and I sitting here like a bread. We're talking about on the margin of life and death, where a morsel of bread makes a difference. It's like, I didn't eat the bread you gave me. Here, take it back. It's like, who does that? Who does that? It says that the Jewish people are amazing, and that in times of struggle and strife and challenge, the Jewish people come together and benefit one another. And that is the message that Yaakov was trying to give. Moshe was concerned also about this encampment, that the Jewish people, because the Midbar was going to be a difficult time. It's going to be a time when they are surrounded by enemies, where they are out in the wilderness, where there are snakes and scorpions and things that, again, create those kind of challenges. Plus, trust the challenge of uncertainty. The biggest human challenge is to not know what's going to happen next. That makes people nervous. In fact, that's one way they torture people, is to keep changing things, to make them so nervous because they have no control. And that Moshe thought that this was going to be a problem. And God is saying, don't worry, Yaakov prepared them. That instead of being at each other's throats, the encampment is, they're going to be able to stay together. So that this, what was set in motion, is able to work for the Jewish people there. Excuse me. That's right. So, and there's a, during Lebanon, when so many people from the north of Israel left their homes, and people in the south of Israel and central Israel opened their homes to people they do not know. You could say, well, they're all Jews. I'm like, since when is that okay? It's like, you're not my kind of Jew, you're not coming to my house. So opened their homes and brought people in, and sadly, the Palestinians tried the same thing when they were being, when we were responding, and said, go to your neighbor's homes. And they're like, go get your own home. So the people didn't open their homes. And so people are just like left out there. So it is a cultural thing of the Jewish people, because that is who we are, and that we open up. So this is a considered a blessing, that there can be an encampment and this working together to bring out the best in one another, that this was the blessing. Moshe, when also the other thing that Hashem tells Moshe in order to comfort him, is that the Jewish people are going to learn from Yaakov, because Yaakov also was able to group the tribes together and to have them be in the best place possible. That north, south, east, and west are not generic directions, that each of them has certain qualities to it. And that Moshe was also concerned that because the Jewish people, this generation was called the Dor De'ah, the generation of knowledge, who had incredible wisdom and spiritual wisdom, and that they were aware that each of these directions had an impact on the tribe that was going to be there. So, for example, Mizrach, which is the way we face when we daven, is east. So east is considered the place where the sun rises. It's considered the place of the place of the rising sun, and that's where Yehuda and Issachar and Zebulun were. Now, you could say, I want to be on the side where the sun rises, because that's like the leadership. I want to be the leader. I don't want to be on the side that is Tzafon. Okay, Tzafon, which is considered, that is the northern side. So we all know, any of us who have northern exposures on our houses, what happens on the north side of everything?
Shady.
Shady, dark. And the word Tzafon literally means hidden. Okay, so Tzafon, when we did that in our Seder, that had to do with the Afikoman. Tzafon, okay, that was the Afikoman, that which is hidden. So this idea of hiddenness is like, well, I don't want to be like on the dark side. And I mean, I have to say, even when we were looking for a home, I had my list of 60 things I was looking for. Mm-hmm. And one of them was, I personally did not want a house that faced north. I'm like, I don't want to have like the ice on my sidewalk and in the winter. I want to face this way. So even at the simplest level, a person could have a preference. When this generation that was knowledgeable about what was the impact of being on this side from a spiritual perspective of that leadership and light, who wouldn't want to be on that side? And yet the tribes all agreed, because that was what Yaakov set in motion, because he set them into the same place to let them know that each of the sides would benefit them and they would have something to contribute and they shouldn't be jockeying. So in this idea of jockeying, which is the human nature thing to do, says that a lot of jockeying, like trying to get, I want to get this, pushing your way to try to get the position. Yeah, mm-hmm. Whatever. Yeah, jockeying is like
jockeying a horse.
It's always, yeah, right. Jockeying, like the jockeying the horse tries to weave in and out to try to get the best position to be closest to the center so that they can get to the finish line first. I'm assuming not a big horse race expert, so I'm not sure if that's what that means. Okay. Anyway, trying to get to the advantage, something for our advantage. So it says it's also human nature even to invoke arguments that in our minds seem like what they're called l'shem shemayim, for the sake of heaven. It's not nothing. It's not that I'm just, you know, greedy. I really have a real reason why I want this. And it's all for the sake of So it says, usually as soon as we say those words, I'm not doing this for me, I'm doing this for the sake of, what can you almost bet that whatever that fill in the blank is going to be is some sort of a cover for it's really about me, but I'm putting it in the context of it's for the sake of heaven. So Shira Smiles gave the example of, now this can go either way, and it's always something can go either way, so it's never so hard and fast. She was giving a description of a rabbi or a teacher in a school that ends up getting fired because a parent who had an issue with their child, with this teacher, then ends up kind of stirring up a whole thing. Not for the sake of it's not about their child's ego or their ego. This is for the sake of the school. It's the sake of the Jewish people that this person should not be allowed to teach. You know, and that's where I'm going to do everything possible to get rid of them. Now, are there teachers that should be gotten rid of? Probably so. But are there also teachers who maybe are gotten rid of because a parent creates a whole thing?
Oh, yeah.
I was almost, you know, someone that when we were at a school, a parent called me and said, we're trying to get rid of this teacher because this teacher did not had bad chemistry with her child. Now, I'm not saying that a teacher shouldn't be able to overcome that and that there wasn't room for improvement. I'm not saying that. My daughter happened to have a fabulous relationship with this teacher, so she wanted me to sign the petition and join the whatever. I said, sorry. But they ended up getting the teacher fired based on this. So it's like, I don't know whether it had merit or not. I didn't get involved. But there is a fine line, and we tend to be very self-righteous of like, I'm doing this for the sake of the Jewish people, for the sake of the wonderfulness of the school, when it really may be a very thinly disguised, this really is about I'm offended for my situation. So it says that Moshe was also worried about this, that the tribes were going to object to the placement, not just out of basic pickiness, but that they would really come up with arguments about why the nature of their tribe should be on the east. You could have all the encampment on the east and nobody else on any place else. And then they would be jockeying for who's in front and who's in back. So it says the same thing that happens on the minor scale, like in a shul, that someone is given the fifth aliyah, and it's like, how come I got the fifth aliyah? I'm like more significant than this person who got the third aliyah. Like whatever. We always have kind of a hierarchy of everything, of what's the better thing. You go to a dinner, how come they sat me in the back? I'm a leader in this community. How come I'm by the door? It's like, well, someone has to be by the door. So hopefully everyone who's there is like a leader in the community. So why is everybody there? And what difference does it make?
It's like,
if people say, I can't hear, it was like, well, you know, if you had a special need, you should have put that in when you sent in your reservation. But usually it's not about the hearing. It's about, I feel like I'm at the bottom of the barrel instead of in the front with the special people. So anyway, it's just one of those things that Moshe is talking about human nature here and how even the greater the person, the more danger there is that they're going to use that in a way that's going to be detrimental, that they're going to use, the tribes would use their very insight and intuition and knowledge about the greatness of each of these sides to have an issue about why it was their side was not the right side. And that God is answering, saying, Yaakov already addressed this by putting them in the position around his casket, and he was able to instruct them about the benefit of literally knowing your correct place. And this is not in a like know your place kind of thing, but know your place. Think about really what is the most beneficial. Sometimes the things that we want are not in our best interest. They really aren't helpful, and it's our ego getting in the way, and it has nothing to do with really what would be the best place for us, what would be the most helpful. And even to the extent that Yaakov put together the tribes that would work most beneficially together. That it was not just which side a person was on, and therefore what side a tribe was on, but bless you, but who you would be right next to, and that would be your team. People do the same thing too. I mean, you know, don't you remember in school you were assigned to work on projects, and they put you with the team? Like, I don't want to be on that team. I want to be on that team. And usually you want to be on a team with the other hard worker who was on the other team, instead of the teacher assigned you, hoping that you would, you know, pull together your talents and be able to work together, and they would see your strengths, and you would be an influence on this one, and it would really bring out the best in all of you. I can't say that our classroom situation always works out as well as the encampment worked out. In fact, it usually doesn't. So this is considered a true miracle. Patricia.
So does it spell out in the Parsha why each tribe is where they are? Do we know? Yeah, do we know why they...
We do know why. It's not spelled out. It's in the commentary.
Yeah, I was going to say it's in the commentary.
Yeah, it's in the commentary about why each one. But for example, let's look at the north. And I did hear about that. Hold on one second. Judah's camp, and let's look at the Dan's tribe in the north. On page 735, Dan's tribe, Dan's encampment are Asher and Naphtali. Asher and Naphtali, verse 25. On page 735, they're on the north. Okay, so the north is the Tzafon, that's the hidden, that's the dark side. That's like, why do I have to be on the dark side? I want to be on the light side. So, specifically about Asher, is a tribe of Asher that they are blessed with oil. Okay, they are blessed with oil in the land of Israel, and they are known for that. And so oil is used for
light.
Okay, so oil is used for light, like the illumination of the menorah says. What do you need in the dark?
Light.
Okay, so if you're a candle, to be object, like, why are you putting me in the dark? It's like, because that's where a candle really works the best, is in the dark. So it says that was supposed to be there. And Naphtali is associated with the quality of alacrity, which is quickness. So how might that be beneficial in a place of darkness? What does the dark season tend to do to people? It's just kind of like, you know, lethargy. Okay, darkness, lethargy, and sluggishness. What do you need exactly on that side in order to benefit the most? You need somebody who has that get up and go even when it's dark. So between the darkness, between the alacrity and the light, that's exactly what you need. Dan is associated with judgment, okay? Judgment and strength. So it's like judgment and strength is like you need to be able to have to be quick here in thinking and judging and figuring out the right from wrong. And where do you need judgment is in times of darkness when things are not clear, to be able to exercise judgment. Who better? Who better to be on the side of Tzafon? And Dan also, absolutely, everybody who's in their place is there for a reason. So that was just the example that I had heard, but there's some for each of the tribes on why they are there. The Mizrach is the rising, the Zerach, to rise up of the sun, says, what's there? So we have the leadership of the Jewish people. So Yehuda, so we can go back to that, to the first one, Yehuda, and who's Yehuda going to be with? He's going to be with Issachar and Zebulun. So Yehuda represents kingship. That's where our kings come from. Those are our leaders. You don't want your leaders always, our idea of leadership is the ones who go out in the front, not the ones who sit in the back and yell out the commands to everybody else. The leaders lead. It's even true in the Israeli army, the number of officers who die in attacks because they lead their groups, they're into the booby-trapped homes and everything. They don't just sit back and say, okay, cannon fodder, you go out in front. They lead. So our idea of leadership is to be in front. So Yehuda is in front. And that kind of leadership must be surrounded by, because our kings are accountable, to the Torah. Yisachar were the Torah scholars, the Torah teachers. That must be together with Yehuda. And who supported the Torah scholarship of Yisachar? Zebulun. So those who are the financial supporters, the ones who they were involved with the shipping, they were involved with providing the money. So you have the money, the Torah scholarship, and the kingship. It's like that is what leads the Jewish people, and that must be what leads the entire camp. That's with the rising of the sun. That is what must be illuminated the most. Interestingly, these directions are also associated, I'm just going to skip ahead here, to the idea that this encampment also follows, kind of going back to the idea of the angels, follows the angels that are our own personal encampment. So before we go to bed, the bedtime Shema references our encampment of angels that accompanies us. As if we are the Mishkan, we are in the center, we are a Mikdash Me'at, we are a holy center. And in front of us, we have, to the front, we have Uriel, which is means the light of Hashem. And to the, excuse me, To the back of us, we have Riphael, which is healing, to catch the dark side, catch us when we fall. That's what we need. And on the right side, we have Michael, which is God's chesed. And on the left is Gavriel, of Gavura, of strength. And over the top of us is called Shechinat Kel, the divine presence which is over us. It says that the acronym of each of those names of Michael, Gabriel, Uriel, and Riphael, that it also spells the word Gemara. What's the Gemara?
Wow.
Okay, the Gemara is like, that's Talmud study. When someone's saying, I'm studying Gemara, they're studying that's what they mean is the Talmud. So the Gemara, which is Gimel, Mem, Resh, Aleph, so it's Gabriel, Michael, Riphael, and Uriel. Says that this is like, what's our encampment now? We don't have a Mishkan. What's our encampment? It says, our encampment is now Torah study. Because what was in the encampment? What was the Mishkan? What was the most important part of the Mishkan? The most important part of the Mishkan was the Aron Kodesh, which had the Torah in it. So basically, we're kind of left with, we have lost the Mishkan. We don't have all of the other accoutrements. But thank God we have the main thing, and the main thing is the Torah. So it's every Jewish person and the Jewish people are still in an encampment, and we are encamped around the Torah. And that every time we study the Torah and engage with that, we are bringing ourselves into the encampment, and we are surrounded by those angels. Those malachim become part of our encampment, and we're part of that encampment.
Wow.
Sorry.
Joanne?
What does Michael represent?
Michael literally means who is like God.
Say that again.
Who is like God? Me, who, Kael, like God. Who is like God? And it specifically refers to who is like God, who's God's greatest strength, which we always associate with the right hand, is God's chesed, God's loving kindness. There was another...
What was Naphtali's job? Did you mention that?
Naphtali was about alacrity, about quickness.
Okay.
He had other jobs too, but Zerizus, of being quick. Naphtali, the actual Naphtali, was the one who ran back to Egypt to get the document that said that Jacob had ownership of the Ma'arat HaMachpelah and not Esav. It was his they sent Naphtali, who was swift as a hind, because Naphtali is a hind, like some sort of a deer type kind of thing.
Bambi.
Is Naphtali.
Yeah.
What was that?
Bambi.
Yeah, a quick Bambi, very quick Bambi. So Naphtali is about alacrity. So that's that quality.
So they were going Zafon, or they were going Mizrach? Which direction were they going?
It's not about the direction that they traveled.
Oh,
it's about which direction around the encampment.
So it's not like they either went
No, so, oh, that's a good question. So Yehuda, regardless of which direction they were traveling when they traveled, Yehuda always went first. So it's kind of like the Rockettes, you know, when they unfold, they like whoever's the leader is the leader. Okay, regardless of what their position is initially. So they would always go. So whoever was the leader would always be the leader, and it went east, south, west, north. And so as they pulled out of Dodge, you know, there was Yehuda in front, the eastern camp, then the southern camp, then the western camp, and then the northern camp at the end. Okay, and the end is also like the dark, you know, like, why do I have to be at the end of the line? It's like, because that's where we need you. So it's like in the army or any kind of armed forces. You don't get to choose where you are in the platoon. You go in the formation that makes sense. Laura?
Were they complaining about where they were? Or you were looking at it as...
Moshe was concerned. So at the beginning we talked about that Moshe was concerned that they were going to complain.
And God says,
don't worry, they're not going to complain because Yaakov... Because Yaakov already arranged the order around the casket.
Okay.
And that's where we started at the beginning of the class. It's like, so what? What does that have to do with, what does carrying a casket have anything to do with marching hundreds of years later? So we're talking about the lessons that Yaakov imparted to them, that was God's answer to Moshe. You don't need to worry. This is going to be just fine.
Okay, because I'm sorry that I missed that. Because the other, it's just interesting psychologically that the idea here is humility. And so inevitably when we're saying, but what about me? Is it really not supposed to be about us? Like, it's interesting that the idea was not, I am in service to God, even if it doesn't seem so glamorous. even though I have this idea about who's more important, most important, you know, that this is all about all of us who are doing a thing.
Right.
So it seems that there is this doubt from the very beginning about our understanding of humility from the very start, if we're worried about whose ego is,
but
it's not about.
But see, that they weren't. So that was the whole point, is that God...
That there was a wonder that there would be...
Moshe was wondering. Moshe was wondering. He was concerned that it was going to be a problem, that human nature was going to kick in, and that under the stress of traveling in the Midbar, that under the stress of the greatness of each of the tribes, because we have a balance of individuality and collectivity, and we don't want, you could say, if you want everyone just to be have a collective, so who needs to have your own banner? Just like have one flag of the Jewish people, just march with your, you know, flag of Israel. That's our flag. It's like, no, we have both. And it's that balance of what do you do with a strong Yehuda and a strong Issachar and a strong Zevulun who are supposed to have their own flag. They are supposed to be individuals. And they are also supposed to contribute their individuality to the group. And what God is telling Moshe is, you don't need to worry that it's going to be human nature as usual, business as usual, as you might expect with a huge group of people. Yaakov already implanted this in them. They're going to be just fine. And they were just fine. And they were able to have their flags. So the flags that they had also indicates, it's like, what is a flag? So that takes us back to the Malachim. It says, what is a flag? Like, even think about color war. I mean, I've seen some color wars where kids, they're just wearing blue shirts and red shirts. You can hardly, and it's like for 3 days, okay? And they get so attached to their team. And they have to earn points for good sportsmanship because sometimes people can get crazy. It's like, oh, you spied on the, you know, the red team or the blue team, whatever it is, you know. They always have, the teams usually have names of, at least at Ramah, there's like past and present, you know, son, and so a friend of mine says, yes, they should have one, teams that are called this and that, here and there, been there and done that, you know, it's like, you know, I thought that was funny.
But actually, I have to say that they're amazing, at least in Denver Jewish Day School. What I love about it is that they cheer the team that wins.
They do. They do, it's amazing. And I have to say, they are given points for their sportsmanship to encourage that, lest it deteriorate into what normally happens when you have opposing teams. Look what people do at sporting events.
Oh, it's horrendous.
You know,
people have died.
That's human nature, okay? We're saying that this is miraculous that this happens, and that this was a gift from Yaakov who blessed the Jewish people that they'd be able to do this, to be able to have the strength and bring it together. So a flag, yes, Valerie.
I'm seeing why Naftali and Asher are at the end in light of what you said. Asher is the light, and Naftali is the swift one, so they're very last, so they're making sure there's no stragglers.
Right, they're the pickup of the stragglers.
So that's kind of...
Yeah, exactly. They're about like, okay, you know, like, you know how they show at the end of the parade, the person sweeping or whatever, it's like, the caboose, it's like, you need a caboose, okay? So that's part of an important job. I keep trying to remind myself, you know, putting things away and getting things away, that's also part of the job, not just like starting the whole thing. It's fun to be the leader. It's more challenging and takes more energy and more strength to be the one who brings up the end.
And then they can protect against Amalek.
So that was a different issue, actually. That was actually a different issue. So, but going back now to the banners and to these flags. So it says the angels, as we said initially, the Jewish people wanted to have flags because the Malachim had flags at Har Sinai. And they're like, I want a flag. It's like, why do they want a flag? It says, what does a flag indicate? Who has a flag? What does a flag mean? So what does a flag mean?
Identity.
Identity, exactly. I have a mission. So it's like why you have your troop flag, and we have the national flag, and we have the flag of Colorado, and we have the flag of Denver, and we have the flag of Israel. And it's like all of these different flags are, this is the mission, this is, and a mission means that it's significant enough and important enough and meaningful enough to have something. We talk about rallying around the flag. I rally around my flag. It's like, what's my banner? What am I rallying around? So in a way, the flag itself represents like a miniature Mishkan idea in that it's what the tribe rallies around in their work in this world and what each of us is supposed to rally around. This, what was meaningful for the Jewish people is they had been slaves. When you are a slave in Egypt, the last thing you have is a personal identity. The last thing you have is a meaningful mission. In fact, the Egyptians, it said, persecuted the Jewish people, not only making them work, but making them do work that was degrading and meaningless, and, you know, they would have them do something, and then they would undo it at the end of the day, just to torture them. The Nazis did the same thing. The Nazis did the same thing. So when you want to torture someone, give them meaningless work. We even learned in the Parsha about the laws of having a Jewish servant, a Jewish slave. You're not allowed to give them meaningless work. You must give them work that has dignity and is meaningful. It can't be work that is just, make work. Kids don't even like this in school. If they get an assignment, if they feel like the teacher is giving them an assignment that's just to take up time, they'll say, oh, this is just like a make work thing. This isn't even anything. That is so humiliating to a human being who is in this world for greatness and is in this world to reach their potential. A flag indicates, so they weren't just saying, I want a flag. It wasn't like, they have a flag, I want a flag. They're saying, we want flags. We want to be like Malachim. We want to be God's angels on earth. We want to be God's messengers on earth. We want to have a flag that tells what our purpose is in this world, that we can rally around, that has significance for us and our household. And in order to have a flag, it's like, it's not really a great idea to have a flag of the whole world. By that time, it's so diluted, you have nothing. If it's a flag for everybody, it's a flag for nobody. And you have to have something. And if each individual has their own little flag, I'm not sure what kind of parade that makes exactly, but you have to have something that is small enough, that it is meaningful enough and descriptive enough of something that is not so huge that it then loses all of its meaning. That's the balancing act that goes on with the Jewish people, with each tribe having its flag. Because you might think, well, maybe there should just be a flag for each group. We'll have an eastern flag, a southern flag, a western flag, and a northern flag. It's like, no, each tribe gets its own flag. Okay, and that would be something that would be meaningful for them, that represented their mission. And where did that mission come from? It came directly from the blessing that Yaakov gave them, that each of his children, hundreds of years earlier. It's like, well, I want a different mission. It's like, sorry, this is your mission. So the Yehuda doesn't get to change its mind because it's ingrained in them. So sometimes we want to trade in our mission because we think that the grass is always greener. I like their mission more than my mission. It's like, your mission was tailor-made for you. The banner was tailor-made for your tribe. This is who you are. It's like saying, I don't want to be me. It's like, well, who do you want to be? It's what it says that it's best to be you because all the other jobs are taken or something. Like, you know, us, that's who we need to be. So that this is what the Jewish people were longing for, is this sense of identity, mission, purpose, rallying point. And all that is embodied in the idea of flags. And in Shir HaShirim, in Song of Songs, there's a reference to flags being a sign of love, a sign of love from God, that the Jewish people would have flags. And that Yaakov promised them, his sons, that in the future that God would make them into an encampment, and that they would be able to manifest all of these great qualities that he had blessed them with at the time of his death, that they would be able to carry that forward. And that's what happens now. All of this is the Medrash that is based on that very first sentence when it says that Hashem spoke to Moses and Aaron saying, the children of Israel shall encamp, each man by his banner, according to the insignia of their father's household. And that this is, and that the Midrash comes in to answer the response of, why is God commanding that there be insignias and banners? Doesn't that seem like a normal thing? Any kind of army or whatever battalion in the world, everyone, that's like, well, kind of the first thing they do. So why are these flags different? These flags are about a heavenly mission, about a spiritual direction, spiritual goal, and reflect the blessings that are coming down from Yaakov.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
So, if you were to look at our takeaway for us today, currently, what came to mind when you were talking in the very literal sense is the walk for Israel, and everybody was walking with the flag, one flag.
Yeah.
But in terms of how we live here in this country as Jews, I'm not sure the question. I'm trying to understand.
What we do?
Yeah,
I mean, for us, what's our flag? So right now, I mean, in a way, it's kind of interesting because since we have the 10 lost tribes, the only tribes that are really around in an identifiable group are the tribe of Yehuda, the tribe of Benjamin, and the tribe of Levi. So those are the Kohanim and the Levi'im. I'm sorry?
Which one is Israel?
Yisrael is basically Yehuda and Binyamin. It's other than the tribe of Levi. So we have the tribe of Levi, a subpart of them is Kohanim, and that's been passed down more faithfully, so people know the Kohanim and the Levim, but they're all from the tribe of Levi. And the tribe of Yehuda and Benjamin, those were the two tribes that were not the lost tribes. So most of us sitting here, in a way, we may not be in this original encampment here, because Yehuda was with Issachar and Zebulun, but in a way, we're all kind of marching under the tribe of Yehuda, and Benjamin was the smaller of those two tribes. So the truth is, and what are we called? We're called Yehudim. We're called from the tribe of Yehuda, but that's become a generic name for the Jewish people. At this point, I think we're safe to march under the flag of Israel, which really represents the Jewish people at this point. I thought what was very nice at the Walk for Israel is that there were groups, there were people there who are not necessarily religiously and philosophically lined up with Zionism or the secular state of Israel who were there. It's like, okay, we can all march under, we support the people of Israel. It's like, okay, you can march under that flag. Just call it that. We stand with the people of Israel. Okay, so that's a good thing. And so I think, to me, that is probably the symbol of our flag. And within that, I was kind of thinking more artistically of if I were making a flag for myself, like, what would it be? What would be on my flag that symbolized or represented what I see and understand my mission to be in this world? And I think that's what I'm going to think about over Shabbos, is what would that flag look like? I may even, when I'm supposed to be doing something else, may even sketch a little something out. But I think that that's a good idea to have, is that we should be able, I wouldn't say to reduce our life to a flag, because we don't want to oversimplify who we are, because our lives are complex. But we should have something in our life Jewishly, that is our centralizing, organizing principle around which other things are focused and directed. Because that's the other thing that I'll add in here a moment, is the whole idea of encampment is about order. It's about having an organized people, and that we don't have a free-for-all. You're here, you're there, you do this, you do that. So there was a lot of the different rabbis talk about the importance of order, of seder, of things being organized. But there was one that's called the Saba of Kelm, who was very interested in order and teaching that to his students in the yeshiva. That it wasn't okay to have your desk and to have your mishnah and then your snack and, you know, and go into your room and then your shoes are like, you know, one shoe's here and one shoe's there. It's like, not okay to have a balagan. It's not okay. There must be order, because Hashem created the world in order, and that's part of our job, is to keep the world in order. And we know from one of the laws of physics that that's going against the laws of physics, okay? Things tend to go out towards disorder rather than order. So if you see something that's organized, that means there has been action placed on it. If you see just a whole bunch of people, whatever, that means nobody's organized that. That means there has not been the human power of organization put on it. So the Saba of Kelm, I thought, gave a really beautiful metaphor and said that order is like is equivalent to the knot on a strand of pearls. A knot, K-N-O-T, the knot that holds a strand of pearls together. It says, because if you think, like, what's a knot? But ever try when that knot breaks?
It's disastrous.
The pearls are all over the place. So you still have valuable pearls, but you can't wear them and you can't find them. So that's our lives too. It says the knot, the strand that holds it all together, that's actually the most valuable part of that necklace, because otherwise you have nothing. So that's true in our lives, from little things, that if we're spending time and we can't find our keys and we don't know where the paper is and we're not sure where the shirt is that I was planning to wear to the simcha, and we're just kind of like all over the place and we're doing things and living in kind of a haphazard way, and as he said, one day I'm on the north and one time I'm on the south and then I'm on the east and then I'm on the west, you end up going in circles, you don't get anywhere. So it says that each of us really needs to make an encampment in our life as well, and to make sure that our day is organized. Now, obviously, we can't anticipate everything, but we should have a plan of how we're kind of marching, that this is a journey that we're going on. And that was the final piece about why what Yaakov had to teach the Jewish people was important to his sons, because specifically his casket was carried from Egypt to the land of Israel. So it was like a miniature version of exactly what the Jewish people were going to be doing over a 40-year period. Obviously, it got much expanded, going from the Exodus from Egypt, coming into the land of Israel. So it says, just as you took my body from Egypt to Israel, and you got along beautifully, and you contributed, and everything was great, so too now you will be able to do, because once something has been done, it makes it easier to do it again, just the basic psychological principle, but that it was inculcated into the Jewish people, I will give you this encampment, and this is how you will leave Egypt in the future. And you will leave Egypt, and you will come into the land of Israel, and you will go in the same encampment. And I will be connected to you, and through the Mishkan as well. It will be the same idea of having that which is unified, of just as we have one father, Jacob's sons, so the Jewish people have one father in heaven, and they have one unifying force of the Torah, which is the unifying factor, no matter where Jews live, no matter what their economic situation is, their political situation, their personal philosophies about anything, there is one Torah, and that is the unifying factor. So if you can hang on to that, like you hung on and hang on to me, because literally a casket had to be carried by their hands. You hung on to the casket, you hang on to the Torah. We say that when we take the Torah out, Eitz Chaim Hi L'machazikim Ba. That it is a tree of life for those who hold fast to it. So you hang on to that, and don't worry, you'll be fine. All of this was God's answer to Moshe when he's like, this doesn't sound like it could be is going to be a good idea. Hashem is like, it's going to be a fabulous idea. And in fact, the Jewish people do that. And as they march and as they go on, they do completely everything that the Jewish that God commanded the Jewish people to do. They encamp. Nobody says squat. And we know the rest of Bamidbar, that there are other people saying things that are inappropriate. If there would have been an issue, we would have heard about it. These flags are a symbol of the success of the Jewish people, what has been implanted in us. God willing, we can take that forward and think about our own personal flags, the flag, the Star of David, the flag of Israel, which really now is the rallying flag of the Jewish people. And it was a beautiful thing on the walk to see so many people marching together in a, for that moment, not thinking about who's saying this about that or has this position about whatever. So we're marching together. And it was a tremendously beautiful sight. So that's the power of the Jewish people. God willing, we'll get to our final destination, and only with the glory we should have of just being like the Malachim of Hashem that came down at Mount Sinai to when the Torah was given, that the flags of the Jewish people should be the flags that accompany us as we go on our way.
Amen.
Have a wonderful Shabbos.
Thank you.
I had mentioned before that I wasn't sure if I was going to teach next week. I am going to. So I will teach next week. And then we will be off on the following Thursday, which is the first Thursday in June, for Shavuos, because it'll
right.
be Yantav.
And if you want to see the flags, near and that, the Mishkan is there, made by actually Germans, very carefully. They everything. All the flags are there too.